Dagens afsnit af Bæk Bag Bolden præsenteres af BMW Danmark, som har lanceret den fuldelektriske BMW iX med op til 619 hestekræfter og en rækkevidde på op til 630 km. Se og prøv bilen hos de danske BMW-forhandlere. Dagens afsnit af Bæk Bag Bolden præsenteres i samarbejde med Ledelseshøjskolen. Vi kobler det bedste fra moderne ledelse med højskoletanken om dannelse gennem dialog. God fornøjelse.
Velkommen til Bæk Bag Bolden, som i dag skal være på engelsk. Og det skal det, fordi jeg er den glade gæst i Nordsjælland hos Tom Vernon. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
And we're sitting here in Farum Park. It's right to dream park, I realize. Yeah. And it's a game day. You have a game later this evening, Brøndby at home.
Yep.
So I really appreciate you taking your time for having a talk with me on a busy day.
No, it's a privilege. Sorry it took so long to get together, but we're here.
But you are a traveling man.
Yeah.
You only landed this morning, I know. Not to describe your everyday routine, but I understand you're traveling a lot. And of course, heading an international group of football, as you do, does take some traveling, I suppose. And everybody would be now very curious to learn more about the American adventure you're going into. I do not expect you to reveal anything in this talk, but it's going to be interesting. So what I actually prepared, question-wise, is questions like, what is the status of Right to Dream, not only in Farum, of course, but and what are the perspectives? And as we start discussing it, no, not discussing it, as you start describing it, we might have a few moments to just discuss some of the key decisions you have been taking over 23 years of Right to Dream development, right?
Yeah.
If you have anything to add.
I think it might be 24 this month, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
What is the English expression for 25 years anniversary? Because in Denmark, if you have been married for 25 years, it's called sølvbryllup, silver wedding, something like it.
Yeah, what? I don't know. I don't know.
No.
There'll be something for the wedding. Is it silver? Is that silver?
In Denmark it is.
Yeah.
Could it be international? Could it be?
Yeah, I'm sure for weddings, but I don't think we have something for business.
And it's not very common anymore. So it might
be 25 years in one place is whenever, you know, we've employed a lot of people the last 2 years especially, and so they come up on LinkedIn and they always, it always says you have a new Right to Dream colleague who's worked in the organization for 1 month. They started 23 and a half years after you, and it kind of it brings it back all the time, like, wow, this has been a long time. But I was very lucky to start really young, so that makes a big difference, I think.
Yeah, and I believe most Danish people know about Right to Dream now, so it's not to make it, you know, a full description of what happened and how did it all turn out. It's more like the key decisions and, of course, getting to the present moment, what is the status. So let me ask you just a few questions before we get started. You used to be an educated coach, right? And you worked for Man United as a scout in Africa.
Yeah, I started in Ghana as a coach with a couple of the big teams there. And then I had the passion for the academy rather than the coaching. But I didn't have any money, so I needed a job and I wanted a flexible job. And the sort of the conditions for scouting for Man United were pretty flexible. You had to visit one country a month and kind of make a report, which meant you had 3 weeks where you didn't have to do a lot. And this was kind of before Y Scout or any sort of detailed video scouting or any of that kind of stuff. So especially there was very little African footage. So it was really to go to one country, visit the academies, try to combine it with an international game or something like that. And then I had 3 weeks where I had a full-time salary, but I could spend my time on the academy. And Sir Alex kind of liked that as well and gave me the space to bring in two players from Right to Dream every year to Man United as well. So he was really supportive in the early days. So I did some coaching and I started my coaching badges very young. Did some coaching and then I did the scouting, but it was all really just a support structure to be building the academy, which I sort of fell in love with the idea very, very early on when I arrived in Ghana.
Can you elaborate a little bit about the love for academies? What does fascinate you about academy?
Well, you know, we're called Right to Dream and you can see in the stadium, it says everyone has the right to dream. And I think, you know, when I saw the construct in Ghana and the things that meant that kids were sort of far away from their dreams, the ability to be involved in bridging the gap is my passion. And what I knew at that time and still now was predominantly football. And so using football as a tool for helping kids to bridge a gap is a passion. And actually, you know, when I came to Denmark and you look at the societal construct here and how kids seem to be given everything, then you wonder, okay, well, is Right to Dream relevant here, or is Right to Dream for Ghana and here it's not? But actually, I think that some of the kids here in Denmark may be further away from their dreams than the kids in Ghana. And you have, so I put it into two categories. There's sort of the material factors that are blocking you from achieving your dreams. And then there's the psychological factors that block you from achieving your dreams. And something that really helped me to fall in love with the club here and the project here was realizing that the idea and the philosophy of Right to Dream could be as relevant here, because I think there's some psychological factors that really hold Danish youngsters back from achieving their dreams, and that many of the things that we believe in Right to Dream and in our philosophy can be a bridge to helping you to overcome that. So I thought for a long time that Right to Dream was in essence a developing world concept. But actually I see it to be a universal concept now, and that the principles and philosophies we believe in are relevant for everybody.
Did you identify some of the psychological barriers that could hold back Danish youngsters from their dreams?
I think social media and materialism, and the materialism driven from social media, whether that be body conscious or you know, desire for material things, is a major factor. And I know from speaking to politicians in Denmark that it's a major national concern for Denmark. And if you watch the social dilemma and you look at the rise in suicide or attempted suicide rates among girls, especially in the West, and the correlation between that and social media, you can see that it's very high and a real concern. And when we had our new investors, the Mansours, in, one of the things that we decided to do was really try and invest in the brand and the storytelling. And so we employed a head of brand from Nike, and he asked me, what's our position on mental health? And this sort of, he described it like the global pandemic related to mental health. And I said, well, I don't think it is a global pandemic. And go to Ghana and spend time with our girls in Ghana and tell me how you feel. And he said, it's amazing. When I went to Ghana, then all the sort of signs that we're seeing emerging in young females in the West don't seem to be the same in Ghana. Hmm. And so from that, and then a lot of our women's teams and girls academy teams here have been to Ghana and have learned and grown and developed and seen a different perspective. And so I think some of that and the experiences of going to Ghana to learn in the same way that our Ghanaians come here to learn, is part of how we can help broaden everybody's perspectives. And often, you know, Ghana is painted as a place where there's little to learn. And that's sometimes because the immediate poverty that you see with an untrained eye when you arrive in Ghana can make you feel like, okay, well, if the roads aren't neat, or if some people seem to be on the street, then there might not be much for me to learn here. But once you scratch beneath the surface, and especially spending time at somewhere like Right to Dream, you realize there's so much to learn and so many things in the societal construct in Ghana, which could be used globally. And I think that a lot of our boys and girls and staff have gone and experienced and learned that and have taken them closer to their dreams. And, you know, we're all just trying to be happy And I think there's a lot of things in Ghana that can contribute to that pursuit.
I really like the emphasis you put on the fact that we can learn from not only Ghana, but African culture, knowing that African culture is very diverse. Mm. But because this 400 or 500 years old idea of, oh, I think you said in, I heard you in a conversation talking about extractive mindset, mm-hmm. is that correct?
Yeah.
That European go there to either mine, could be gold in Ghana, or mm. players, or resources, and leave again without learning anything. Mm. And you go the other way around it. And that's why you bring Danish players, in this case, Danish players to Ghana.
Yeah. We started the first year we were here, we said we want to take the under 12, under 13 boys to Ghana. And it was hard in the first year. Everybody was unsure. And we met with the parents and did a deal where I think six of the parents got to go as well. But those kids, and now, you know, some of them are in the first team. And many of them are elsewhere doing really well. They got so much from it, and the parents saw that their kids got so much from it that it became much more of a popular thing here, where we don't have to really sell it or explain it too much more to the parents that the kids will go to Ghana. So the boys go at under 13 and under 19. And the girls' academy has been, I think, once, maybe twice. We're newer with our girls' academy, so we got disrupted a little bit with COVID as well. And then the first team has been there recently as well. So it's a key part of our philosophy. And now we have Right to Dream Egypt operating, and we opened the new campus in the summer. We have a soft opening in the summer and then a big opening later in the year. And the campus is only 20 minutes from the pyramids. And so it's like you have just unbelievable opportunities as well to go to other places and reflect and learn and broaden your perspective. And that process, I think, takes you closer to your dreams, which makes us, in my view, a universal concept.
We've been talking for almost 12 minutes now, and we haven't said anything about football games and football training and football players in that sense. And I'm not even sure we're going to talk about it during this talk.
Because
what is really fascinating for a football man like me, I've been 35 years in, I know Danish, but still Danish football. And I've never met any other club, any other organization really talking so much and actually working and walking the talk about purpose, character building, and so forth. Could you maybe help me a little bit to understand the benefit I can get it for as a parent, but from a football perspective, why is it so important that you first of all have a character building program, and you also have this very new for Danish football, at least the purpose department. I believe five people working in purpose department. Tell me a little bit more about the perspectives from that.
Well, I think the original idea was when, in the early days, when I was sort of trying to fact find around how to structure an academy and speaking to a lot of people, and you know this as well as I do, when you work in the youth development phase and you ask a coach, like, okay, from all the players that you had, which ones made it and what made the difference? Most of the time, they'll tell you, well, it was the one with the strongest character who made it through. And so the really kind of basic early idea was, well, we're very deliberate about how we develop the body and how we develop the techniques. But if coaches keep saying that it was the one with the strongest character who made it, why aren't we as deliberate about how we develop character? And that was an early thought in Ghana. And so we wrote a character curriculum probably 15 years ago, trying to help our players develop their character in the same way that they would develop their first touch or their speed endurance or whatever else it might be. So, and that's evolved in sort of in multiple iterations. And I think that, you know, the most important thing is the experiential component of developing your character and getting out of your comfort zone and some of the things that we already touched on. So we've, in periods, we've done a lot in the classroom. In other periods, we've done slightly less, and it's still an experiment. So we're still looking to find the balance. But we deliberately want to test and expose and stress the growth of your character in the way that we do, you know, when we play a talented U15 in the U17s to push him out of his comfort zone. We see the same thing in character development, and that, you know, Fleming's big drive on our development environment is psychological safety. And so the balance between pushing the boundaries on your character development within a psychologically safe environment is a really interesting thing to innovate around and to try to find the right balance.
And it's also a part of your talent ID, right? Identifying, well, not necessarily what character is already there, but the interest in building a character. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think we, you know, we pay attention to it. Mm. You know, we don't recruit too many players from outside, so we know the characters of our players really, really well before they play in the first team. So I think when we recruit so young, I don't.
10 years old?
Yeah, yeah. Generally. I don't think that there's many examples where you say this is a character that can't be worked with. It's true. About, okay, what are the, you know, our character is a result of our lived experiences. So how can we help and develop and mold characters to get ready for the first team? And sometimes that hasn't worked, but majority it has.
This is taking me a little bit off the route, but I think this, for me, is very interesting because character. I also heard you talking about soul, which is not necessarily the same as character, but could be, for some people, quite the same. From a personal point of view, identity is not necessarily the same thing as character, but identity. I see young people all around trying to build an identity, maybe even more. And as they get into our age, we try to get rid of identity because it's more a straitjacket or something like that. So the fact that we are offering support to a character program, and that might lead to an identity, which is quite directing for life, I suppose. Does that give you a lot of responsibility? I suppose it does. What do you think about that responsibility?
I think I'll divert slightly in how I answer the question, but... you know, one of the things that I saw about academies as well was that often graduates of academies around the world didn't talk particularly fondly about their experiences in the academy. Maybe a higher percentage if they got into the first team.
Right.
But those who didn't get into the first team, you know, it's a fairly big rejection of your big passion at quite a young age. It doesn't really happen in other things in the same way. And as I'm sure you know, we have a lot of students who are studying in America and doing well in America. And the American education student-athlete model really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And there you can meet a 60-year-old who is so proud of the university that they went to. And so you may have heard me say this before, but my question was always like, why can't... academy graduates speak like that about their academies, regardless of whether they made it to the first team or not? And the answer is, well, if you take a holistic view to the experience and the individual and the outcomes that you're trying to create, then, you know, first team obviously is an ambition and a nice outcome, but the benchmark for us is like, how do our graduates who didn't make it into our first team talk about their experience, and do they want to connect back, give back, you know, or do they have that sort of slightly more bitter experience and or bitter feeling about the time, which, you know, when someone tells you you're not good enough at football, is that's a tough thing to come out positively when you have to do that. And we have many examples across both our Danish and Ghanaian academy of graduates speaking really passionately about their time, even though they didn't achieve sort of their sort of foundational football dream with us.
Could that be because your academy is not a, what is that in young people's tongue? It would be, it's a single use device. It's not just one parameter. for your academy, because you have this holistic view that might not even be putting the football education in the first place. What I'd say, it's not the primary focus.
Yeah, and when we were sort of conceiving Ghana, and it's a little bit, you know, you asked at the start about sort of the foundational decisions along the way, which made the difference. And one of the big decisions for us was to say how does Right to Dream contribute to the national development agenda, and that I think is one of three or four sort of foundational decisions. And you know, I know you've heard this already, but I'll say it again. When I looked at the other academies that were in Ghana, and I saw this more single use purpose that they applied to the academy, which was, can we get a player to come and play for our club in Holland or our club in Austria or whatever else? And there was no other sort of purpose. I saw that use of resource was a conflict with how that resource could be applied to the progress and development of Ghana. And so we decided to try and contribute as best we could to the national development agenda. And practically how that looks is that when we go to a village scouting, we, in our first iteration, only went to look for the best players. And then after that, we said, okay, can we, if a player's not going to make it, can we help him with another path? But we were still only going to the village to look for the best player. And then we said, well, with what we've learned about America, if we looked for the most intelligent kid in the village who was also quite a good footballer and he could end up at an Ivy League university, that might be a more responsible use of our resources towards contributing to Ghana's development agenda. And then we realized that, well, we can't only go to a village and look for boys if we say that we care about Ghana. So we have to do boys and girls. And then according to the resources that we have, we think that we can produce kids who can get a world-class education on the back of football, as well as kids who can become world-class footballers on the back of football. So those were a couple of the things that we did to say, this is how we can integrate into society and prove to a country where we're guests that we're actually trying to contribute in a meaningful way rather than extract. So I think that that was a fundamental decision. I don't think we would have made it without having taken that decision. And so that mindset then obviously creates a holistic development environment, because we're trying to contribute to development of Ghana, not just our own objectives.
And you wouldn't have been able to make it, as you said, if you had only been interested in bringing players to a foreign club.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. You also talked about funding at a given time, that you saw a crucial decision. Now I'm actually getting back to the agenda that I had about the key decisions you had to take about funding, that you could have gone with the charity funding, which is big in Africa in general, or with the the funding from getting profit for the money getting into to the program. Tell me again, why is the latter decision the most important one?
I think that there's a strong history of how Africa has been portrayed to the West in order to unlock charitable dollars. And it's one that doesn't reflect the excellence that exists within African society. It's one that reflects the scarcity. And actually, I think that there's an abundance of talent, culture, and value in Ghana that needs to be reflected, and it needs to engage with the world rather than beg for handouts, which is how a lot of charitable initiatives kind of tell the story. The more emotional they make you feel about someone who has less than you, the more money you can make. And much of that important life-saving work. But when we're dealing with some of the most talented children on the planet, that's the wrong narrative. It's just not a fact. It's not even right. It's just not a relevant narrative to who they are and what their potential is. But we did it. We did it at various times for a while. And what we could see is that our students did not want to be portrayed within that narrative because they didn't identify themselves within that narrative. They were coming up and winning some of the best youth tournaments in the world. They were seeing their graduates playing at the World Cup and going on to do really well. So why should they be saying please or thank you to people for opportunities? Not that you shouldn't say please or thank you, but in this construct of we need to be grateful for the opportunities we're given, or it's a privilege that we get these opportunities more than a kid in Denmark, for example. And I've given a couple of examples previously, but we can talk to a sponsor and tell the story of Caduce, and then the potential sponsor can say, "Oh, have you spoken to the foundation?"
Yeah.
But if you tell the story of Damsgaard, no one will ever tell you, "Have you spoken to our foundation?"
No.
And so there's a lot of things that we've learned in that space about the strength, abilities, and possibilities and potential of Ghana that need to be reflected in a story, an accurate story of excellence, and not in one of any type of sympathy. So that you know, naturally takes you into playing in the sort of the for-profit world, because those are essentially your two choices. Either you're in the not-for-profit or the for-profit world. And so we said, okay, how can we be really progressive in that space? And that led to us, one of the reasons for us buying a professional football club.
And I know you've been asked this question before because I heard you answer it, but given the fact that elite football very often is a hyper-capitalistic society, I mean, more or less the extract of capitalism, and you also, in your value chart of what you operate with, cherish a lot the growth of individuals and the possibility to offer something to the bigger community. These two things might not always go hand in hand, but trying to earn money and create money for profit, not necessarily your profit, but bringing in funding that would be for profit, could be feeding the capitalistic perspective, which is sometimes more dominant than the more holistic perspective. I'm not sure if any question is popping out of this talk, but how would you see the fact that you are with the football business tapping into some of the most hyper-capitalistic world that you will find?
I think, I haven't worked in anything else, but I don't know. I mean, I think football still has it, and clubs still have an essence of being about the community, and academies still have an essence of being about developing young people. So, you know, because people talk about football a lot, and I think some people don't want it to go in that direction, fans in some ways don't want it to go in that direction, then it can be portrayed more because it's such an interesting thing to talk about as being hyper-capitalistic. But I think, you know, some other sectors that don't make the news as much, or maybe more so. So for us, it's certainly been the model that has created the most opportunities and has led to the growth in Egypt and hopefully future growth as well. So it's a model that has served the growth of Right to Dream well. And obviously from our perspective, there's a lot of different money in the world and in the world of capitalism, and the Mansours, when they came in to accelerate our growth, could have done anything in football and were looking at buying a Premier League football club before. But when visiting Ghana, saw that this was something unique and different that could live in this mix of a social engagement with society and the passion and voice, passion and excitement that football could create, and the life-changing opportunities that football could create. So, you know, we I don't think there's a pure, like a brilliant business terminology for the kind of business that we are. And I'm, you know, there's interesting things like B Corps that you can see out in the world now, and different ways of defining your business. But, you know, what matters for us is how our employees and our kids feel about being in the business, rather than how we sort of define it to the outside world as much. So I think that we found a happy balance in that regard. And I think the results that we produce in human development speak for themselves in that regard, that they are expensive. You know, it is expensive to develop kids holistically, and often you're not only having to pay for that development, you're having to pay the kid as well to be with you, because that's how football works. So it's a really expensive model, but it's, so far it seems to be working.
I'm trying to find out. I'm not here to be over criticizing it, but one of the things I meet very often when I talk to coaches, especially for academy coaches, maybe everybody who's trying to take on responsibility for somebody's development, that they say their great motivation is to see young people develop themselves into what they could be, you know, transforming their potential. And I very often feel a little bit offended about it, because, first of all, did you ask the kids if they wanted to do it? And second of all, it's like, you know, having a hook in other people that you better develop, God damn it, otherwise I'm not being satisfied. So having the internal motivation, not depending on if anybody else will develop according to your plans, having your internal motivation is, for me, absolutely key to be able to do it with a new sort of clear vision. Do you have a motivation for yourself, except for, besides of developing young people, do you have a motivation for yourself that will only be fulfilled within you?
Well, you talked about identity before, and running this project has been an interesting exploration of my own identity, and because we called it Right to Dream, then it's very easy for. It's very easy to think that Right to Dream is my identity. And I felt that for a long time. And I deliberately separated my identity from Right to Dream and did a lot of work on that, but still come back to this process of being a bridge and connecting people and either breaking down barriers or building bridges. I think it gives you a place within society, and it gives you a role within society, which is what we all look for. And I think I have a talent in that space, and so that's what I like to do. And I like the connections that come from the communities that you exist in by playing that role. So I can clearly see in my mind that if I wasn't involved with this organization, that I would still choose to play that type of function within whatever sort of community or society I found myself in.
I really enjoyed that answer. So I just leave it for a moment. And as I leave it, I'll just give a small space for a message from the partner of this podcast. Okay. As we just dwell on it. Comes here.
Dagens afsnit af Bæk Bag Bolden præsenteres i samarbejde med BMW Danmark, som netop har lanceret den fuldelektriske BMW iX1, en SUV med 313 hestekræfter og op til 440 km rækkevidde. Besøg din nærmeste BMW-forhandler til en prøvetur og hør nærmere. BMW iX1 fås fra 449.600 kroner.
Tom, I'm trying to bring myself back to the original agenda that I put up. Trying to pinpoint some of the crucial decisions? You already talked about a few, the way you fund it and the fact that you will bring in girls as well since 2013, yeah. I suppose, right?
Yeah. And we have a great girl from Ghana playing in our first team now for the women.
Yeah.
Alongside a lot of incredible girls coming through the academy. I think we're doing a great job here on limited resources with our girls academy as well. It's really exciting to see a lot of them coming through to the first team.
This is a podcast. Nobody can see your face, but I can see your face. You're just lighting up as you talk about this, the female players.
So yeah.
It's really something for you. I can see that. Take me through some of the more crucial decisions, if you can. I'm not sure if you can remember all of them, but of course, for a Dane, buying FC Nordsjælland would be one of the decisions that we think is crucial. How have you seen the development, the crossroads of Right to Dream as it has been?
Often, you know, the economics of starting an academy are really tough. So, you know, if you start with 10, 11-year-olds coming into the academy and you view it as a business, then it might be 10 years before some of those players become profitable. So there's not many businesses that have a 10-year capital requirement before there's the potential for any profit. So, and that's even more so in Ghana, where there's no sort of government state support. There's not really a sponsorship market. So it's really tough business. So I think the key decisions for us have been around sticking to our values when commercially that didn't necessarily make sense. And I've shared, you know, a couple of examples already, but there's one story that I share regularly with anybody who wants to listen.
I do.
Which was in 2008, I started the business by setting up another business. It was a sports tourism business, and it was doing quite well, and I was making good money from it, and I was using all the money to run Right to Dream. And then in 2008, in the global recession, the business collapsed overnight, and we had about 6 months of cash flow, and I was pretty sure that the academy was going to go bust. And I'd saved quite a lot of money, but I'd used all of it to build our new campus, which was a mistake. But I was ambitious and didn't see a rainy day coming. I just saw clear skies, and then things changed, and so we were really in trouble. And so I called everybody that I knew, including a friend at Nike, and she said, "Well, a number of our employees have just left to join Man City because they just got the new investment from the other Mansours. And maybe you should call Man City and see whether they can help you." So we did, and we went and played a game with them, and we were really desperate, actually. You know, we could see very clearly in our mind, having to sit down with all the boys in the academy and say, "Sorry, it's over, you have to go home." And so we played a couple of games against Man City and did really well. And then they said, "Okay, we'd like you to go and meet the CEO and talk about how we could work together." Mm. And so I spoke to one of my mentors, who's a guy called John Powers in New York. And he said, "When you go in, tell them about all the boys who are studying in the United States." And I said, "John, they don't want to hear about the boys studying in the United States. They want to hear about the footballers that we can produce, and they might like that as a side story, but they don't want to hear about that as the primary objective for a partnership." And he said, "No, I really think you should start with that, and you should tell that story in detail before you talk about football." And you know, one of the key things if you choose to have a mentor in life is that you've got to follow the advice when you don't agree with it. Otherwise, you may as well just like do what you want. So I trusted him and I followed the advice, and that led to us getting a partnership with Man City, which while there was some problems with that partnership, undoubtedly it meant that Right to Dream survived. I couldn't have seen another way because they started funding our operating costs. And a few years later, I met Gary Cook, who was the CEO, and I asked him, like, why did you do the deal with Right to Dream? And he said, well, when you came in and gave a presentation about kids going to Hotchkiss and all these other great schools in America before you talked about football, he said, I knew that we could go anywhere in Africa and find someone who said they could help us to produce players. And Africa is full of agents who say they have the, you know, the best flow of players and everything else. But you came in and talked about things, and you said before, you know, my face lit up talking about the girls. He said, your face lit up talking passionately about this. And he said, in a space where, you know, sometimes it's difficult to trust, and it's a hard area to work out in African football, here was someone trying to do something different. So we thought, if that was your foundation for what you stood for, and that's what you wanted to talk about first, then we could build from that into, you know, player development and all those types of things. And that's still one of my most important business lessons, is to lead with what you really care about in how you communicate, but also in where you make your decisions and where you invest. And there's never been a clear line between the investment dollars that we put in and the outcome that we're expecting. It's always, you know, a crazy, convoluted journey to get to where you're going to. But you have to stick to your core reasons, and you have to wear them proudly on your sleeve, and you have to talk about them proudly. And even when you think they don't make any sense, which I really didn't feel comfortable in that meeting, especially knowing that it was kind of a make or break moment for Right to Dream, I didn't feel comfortable talking about that. But now when I speak to staff or when I speak to you, I've learned to become comfortable talking about the things that matter to me most. And that's led to people gravitating towards us, like our new investors who are taking Right to Dream around the world, because we've had the courage to wear our heart on our sleeve and talk about those things. And I think that, you know, that's purpose, and that's, you know, leading with your purpose. And that's something that I think has attracted a lot of fantastic people to come and work here. And with the success that we've produced, I'm sure that a lot of our staff get great offers from other organizations who can pay more than we do, because they'd like to produce some of the outcomes that we do. But as long as we keep talking about these things and connecting back to the real reasons for why we do stuff, it's so far it's worked for us and continually led to sort of growth and success. So I often don't feel like doing it, like leading with your heart and talking about the things that matter the most, but it's a key learning and now a deliberate sort of business objective of mine or strategy of mine.
Er du interesseret i at udvikle dit personlige lederskab? Så tag med Ledelseshøjskolen på vandring Bornholm rundt på 4 dage. Mens vi går de underskønne 120 km, sætter vi fokus på værdier, motivation, performance og livsbalance. Så vil du have større gennemslagskraft, større rækkevidde og større levedygtighed. Så tag med os ud og gå.
And I believe meaningfulness, purpose, not necessarily the same thing, is definitely the new black, or so, sort of the most important for many people, more important than money. So I do understand your lesson, and it reminds me of, I mentioned this before in this serial of podcasts, but it reminds me of, I believe it was an Argentinian coach. He was coaching Inter Milan, Herrera, something like it. And he said, it's so much more preferable to fail on your own ideas rather than on others. So I do like the idea that, well, it's a double failure if you lose yourself in trying to succeed and it doesn't. You don't, right?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it was not very well translated. As we talked about character earlier, just sticking to your description of the tough moment in 2008, this is another difficult one to translate maybe, because I have got it from German. I'll try to translate it to English. I heard that somebody said talent is is flourishing with the wind in their back, but character is flourishing with the wind in your nose, more or less. And you both want to develop talents and character. How do you mix that exposure, well, the wind with and against them? How do you mix it? It's football. I know it will mix it by itself, but outside football.
Yeah, it's a good question. I remember one particularly challenging parent that we had, and they were in talking about a challenge that their kid was facing in one of our academies. And I said, yeah, but this is great because this challenge is going to build them to be stronger and to deal with other challenges in future. And she said to me, I only accept that answer if I know that you deliberately designed the challenge that he faced. But if the challenge that you're now trying to frame as a positive is as a result of you not running the organization properly, then I don't accept that this is good for him. And so her challenge was like, you need to deliberately manipulate challenges for our kids rather than just allow them to emerge. And so I thought about that. I always think about that actually in terms of how much can you deliberately create challenging environments versus just sort of letting life happen and know that for each class coming through, you know, there's always going to be the same set of challenges. Some don't grow physically, some can't develop tactically, some can't make the grades to make, you know, the university that they want to get into, and all of these challenges are going to emerge. So it definitely comes back to a base of psychological safety, that you feel safe in our environment to talk about the challenges that you're facing, and to be honest about that and build strategies to overcome them with the people that are around you. And so, as I said to you earlier, we talk about and focus on that a lot in our academies. And then after that, I think, you know, the travel is a brilliant teacher, and travel takes you out of your comfort zone. And I don't think it needs to be too much more scientific than that in relation to the travel piece. You know, it changed my life, and I've seen it for our Danes and our Ghanaians when they swap environments. Our Egyptians have just started traveling as well, and then we go out to other environments as well. And if we had the choice hypothetically between playing a tournament in Barcelona or Brazil, we would always choose Brazil. If we have a choice between Amsterdam or Japan, we would always choose Japan. And so the more that you can broaden that perspective, I think is key. And then, you know, and then the beauty of football is that you play every week, and it throws up that challenge every week as well. So some of it's not revolutionary in terms of what I'm talking about, but going back to those basic principles, I think is part of the answer.
I get that. A few minutes left for the remaining crossroads in the development of Right to Dream. Once you bought FC Nordsjælland, I understand you explained it was in order to sort of grow the investment possible from the funding, from the money that wants to make profit, more or less, because now you have access to transfers. By the way, I talked to a Danish guy, you might be familiar with him, Thomas Thor. He's running an academy in El Cambio in Uganda, which is in the first 10 years, as you just described earlier. It's a bit tough, right? And he said, sooner or later, they need to get their way into the transfer business, because that's a way to make a sustainable academy. Anyway, what other crossroads did you see after 2008? You had the extra funding from the Mansour family. Is that a crossroad that took a big decision for you? And
yeah, I think 2008, then obviously coming into FCN, and then the Mansours coming in with the big let's say junctions that you reached where you had to decide to go one way or another, and those two coming into Denmark and Mansours have been the big ones in the last 7 years. Denmark was a big risk and huge challenge coming in, and not something that I would ever go back on if I had the chance to, even though at some periods in the journey then I felt like I would have liked to be out if I could, because it's been extremely difficult. And then you know, we were sort of getting to a point where Ghana and Denmark together was starting to look solid and a nice potentially sustainable project that people were starting to understand and could be successful. And then why bring in a partner like the Mansours, and why stretch the organization to Egypt and to beyond Egypt as well? And I've always been inspired by growth and the opportunities that Right to Dream can create in different parts of the world. And so we took that decision to go to the next level again, just after me and Jan and Phil Radley especially felt like, okay, we'd just taken this step to get FCN and Right to Dream to be stable, and then we're going to go again so quickly afterwards and take another big expansion. So those have been two big crossroads for us.
And how do you see the perspectives from here? Because the eternal growth might stretch the organization even over the limits. How do you see the perspectives from here? Everybody knows about the American project being at the doorstep. And how do you see the perspectives as you sit 2023?
I think, you know, one of the things I'm excited about, and you said it, is that I think you said purpose is the new black. That there's a lot of tremendous people in football who want to look for a better balance between something that's meaningful for them, that they feel proud to explain to their kids, this is what they go and do at work, and they can imagine sitting on the beach at the end of it, having a beer and feeling satisfied about what they did with their life. I think in football there's a big desire to achieve that balance. And so if I look at how we've managed to build a management team in Egypt, where brilliant people have come from, you know, come out of the woodwork, so to say, to be the leadership team of Right to Dream Egypt, and that you can feel that the essence of what we stand for has been replicated there with people who we didn't know in 2019. They're not our own people from our group. They're new people we've employed in Egypt and in other parts of the world where we may go. I get that same strong feeling. So I think that people are looking now more than ever to work in an organization like ours and get that balance. And so that growth that you say that could stretch you beyond the limit is if your existing people have to do more. And we've definitely asked our existing people to do maybe a little bit more than is normal. And we've got some brilliant people who've really stretched and lent into making the next level of the dream happen. But you know, with the support of the Mansours, we also don't have to stretch people forever. We can stretch for a bit and then bring in new people. And then the exciting thing, as we've seen in Egypt with new people coming in, is that they have a different interpretation of Right to Dream. And there isn't one sort of universal truth of how Right to Dream should be. And Denmark has shaped the understanding of Right to Dream for me in profound ways. And Egypt will do that again. And then other markets will do that again. So I always get teased by the management for this, but I see Ride Your Dream to be a soup, and you go to different markets and you take the best spices, which are pieces like parts of the character or the society that you think are most positive. And those are the flavors that Ghana or Denmark or Egypt have to offer, and you put them all into one soup, and that keeps getting blended, and hopefully it tastes better and better over time. And yeah, it's not the best analogy. And I'm friends with them with Klaus Meyer, and so I told Klaus Meyer that I wanted him to come and help me to make this soup in FCN to reflect it all. He said, "Tom, it's one of the cheesiest ideas I've ever heard. It's not gonna work." All my management were really delighted to hear that he thought it was a terrible idea as well. But I keep talking about it as an idea for how hopefully, if we're smart enough over time, more and more locations can become part of it, and more spices and flavors from different parts of the world can come in to build something that can taste even nicer.
I'm a shitty chef. I always overdo it with spices, and yeah, it doesn't really taste that well.
Well, that's so, the danger, right?
Yeah, it is. Maybe this is last question. Do you look upon Right to Dream as a company or as a movement?
A bit of both, I think. And as I said before, I don't think there's a perfect sort of business structure to define, you know, who we are. I think different people in the organization would have different answers to that as well, which I think is good. And graduates would have different answers as well. I think our brand and the way that we're developing our brand has a different view to how, you know, maybe our football department would look at it. So I don't feel a need to, you know, clearly define an answer to you in that regard, but achieving sustainability in our organization is key. And in that regard, we have to look at ourselves as a business, and we have to be as proactive as we can be on generating revenues, coming up with new ideas for sustainability, because otherwise we slip back into that sort of construct that we talked about earlier, where we're saying we're good guys and so you should help us because we're trying to change the world, but we, you know, we need to stand on our own 2 feet.
Thank you, Tom. And did you notice we didn't talk about any football game at all? I don't think we did.
No,
no title. And you're playing tonight and you might be back in the first position. We don't know yet, but that's a totally different talk. So thank you so much, Tom, for taking your time. It was interesting for me. Hopefully interesting. I can do this in Danish now. Også håber jeg, det her er interessant for både Jesper Christensen, Tommy Hansen, Lars Jol, som er nogle af dem, jeg har skrevet ned, der har skrevet ind og ønsket netop Tom Vernon. Og hvis der er andre, der synes, det er interessant, så er det bare dejligt. Og så kan I skrive ind på trosbæk.com, som de andre har gjort for at komme med ønsker til kommende gæster eller emner. Mange tak, fordi I lyttede med.
Dagens afsnit af Bæk Bag Bolden var præsenteret af BMW Danmark, som har lanceret den fuldelektriske BMW iX med op til 619 hestekræfter og en rækkevidde på op til 630 km. Se og prøv bilen hos de danske BMW-forhandlere. Dagens afsnit af Bæk Bag Bolden var præsenteret i samarbejde med Ledelseshøjskolen. Vi kobler det bedste fra moderne ledelse med højskoletanken om dannelse gennem dialog. Tak fordi du lyttede med.